Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Are babies our future? The science behind early childhood education for children and families is an event that is scheduled for next Friday, June 15th in Chambersburg. Promotion for the event says that each and every person has the opportunity to impact the future of Franklin County. Obviously, early childhood education goes beyond Franklin County, but a good example of what a lot of people are talking about and need to talk about. But how and why is this event and early childhood education so important? Joining us on today's program is Karen Grimm Thomas, Director of External Relations with the Office of Child Development and Early Learning here in Pennsylvania. Ms. Grimm Thomas, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Also joining us is Franklin County Commissioner Bob Thomas. Commissioner Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you today, Scott.
And by the way, the two of you aren't related, right? Even though you have the same last name?
No.
Although she said she has a Bob Thomas
in her family.
Okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to
Uncle Bob.
Just wanted to make sure that that was the case. If you have a question or a comment about today's topic, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Commissioner Thomas, let's talk about the event, first of all. Are babies our future? The science behind early childhood education for children and families. How did this event come about?
Well, it came about really after I was at a conference and I heard about the collaborations that other counties and other states were doing to help to bring more awareness and more programs and services to parents of newborns, and the reason for it. I happened to be at the National Association of Counties conference in Washington, D.C. in February. And one of our speakers was the speaker that I have coming here at the event, Brenda Harden Jones. And I'm telling you, she was the most powerful and influential speaker I've ever heard. And when we talk about the science of early childhood development, you could think, and coming from a PhD professor at a major university.
Yeah, she's from University of Maryland.
Could almost think that they could be talking over your head, because I don't claim to be God's gift to early childhood education. Let's be clear about that. She spoke to me. And her presentation was something that was so impressive that I asked her, I said, if we can ever do such a thing in Franklin County, because it is right up the street, it's about a two-hour drive, would you be willing? And she said, well, I could do it in the summer. And that's why we're doing it now. And we're doing this for the major reason of to increase the awareness as to what's happening in our society today. What are the issues and problems, and how can we fix it? And I'm telling you, Brenda is top-notch.
Well, let's talk about what you just mentioned there, talking about the future, talking about the problems. Now, I'm assuming you're talking about what counties are dealing with, what parents are dealing with, what schools are dealing with. What kind of issues? Why is this a county issue?
Well, it's a county issue, it's a state issue, it's a federal issue. Already this morning on Morning Edition, we heard about the abuse of spouses, sexual abuse, drug and opioid abuses in families, and the effects on the children. I mean, all of these things cost money. We're talking about public spending. Secretary Wetzel, you've heard him on the program before.
Secretary John Wetzel, Department of Corrections,
yeah,
yes.
And he's always talking about how we need to get better at the beginning, because we're never going to stop this spending if we don't do it now. But, you know, for all the things we spend money on, health care, for juvenile, children and youth, drug and alcohol, adult corrections, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. We talk about education, children not ready for school, and what schools have to spend to get kids up to speed, to try to get them up to speed. I'm just telling you, it is an issue that is so big right now that we must make people more aware.
Just for background purposes, so what you're talking about is that the research has shown, and Susan Grimm-Thomas will bring you into the conversation as well, that the research has shown that children that are involved, that are educated very early on, whether it's pre-K, whether it's Head Start, there are a lot of programs out there, but that children who receive these type of educations, this kind of attention, that they are less likely to be offenders later in life, that they are more likely to do better academically in school. What can you tell us about that science?
Well, you're right. We do know. I mean, I think a lot of folks think about are kids ready for kindergarten? And I think what the science has really shown us is that it goes way beyond that, that when kids have quality early learning, that all those things that you just mentioned, you're setting them on a trajectory where what they are getting in those early grades, then they can just continue to build on. They're developing the social skills, those soft skills that they need, that many workers or employers say that we really need to see in the workforce. So it's not just about their academics. It's about being able to get along with other folks. It's about feeling like they have a purpose and feeling like they can get along in the world. And again, I think we often focus on our kids ready for kindergarten, and it's such a bigger issue for us. So we see that kindergarten teachers will tell you when kids have early learning, we can tell. They come into our classrooms ready. They can sit and they can follow directions. And those skills then just build. As kids get older, they just keep building.
What's different, though? I mean, early childhood education, the programs that we'll be talking about today, are relatively new, last 20, 25 years, maybe not even that old. It used to be that for the first 5 years before a child went to kindergarten, it was the parents who provided that type of, you know, training or, you know, what a child learned as far as social skills, as far as being ready to go to kindergarten. What's changed? What's different?
Well, I would kind of push back a little bit and say that it's not quite been that way. I came into the early childhood world through the Head Start door. And okay. So Head Start they celebrated their 50th anniversary. A couple of years ago.
Hey, the mind starts going. Hey, just had a birthday last week, so go ahead.
Right. So I think, you know, it's been quite a long time that we've understood that particularly kids that are growing up in environments where they might not have access, they might not have resources to a lot of the things that you were alluding to in terms of, you know, kids growing up in two-parent families that maybe financially have more security and have access to libraries and museums and books. So we knew quite a while ago that we had children that were growing up in environments where, despite how loving families might be, they didn't have access to those kinds of things. And these are probably families, parents who didn't have access to those kinds of things when they were younger. So we've known for a long time that we need to, particularly with kids that are at risk, that are growing up in lower incomes. I think what we're also realizing, though, that as families are becoming busier, we've got more women in the workforce now, we're realizing that all kids benefit from these kinds of things. And that, you know, regardless of what a family's socioeconomic status is, particularly if moms are working and kids are in care, that it's not just babysitting, that kids need to be in quality settings that are really challenging them and are rooted in science, rooted in our understanding of how young children learn, with qualified teachers that have training, that are, you know, have great supplies and are using a research-based curriculum, that even for kids that come from more affluent backgrounds, if they're not in those quality settings, if they're in settings that aren't doing those things, that they're not going to benefit from them.
Right. And to that point, you know, when we have someone, a child who is neglected or, you know, mom, you know, there's a TV show on right now about an adult who is, he's an addict. And it goes back and forth to his earlier years. And you see his mom was an addict herself, an alcoholic and an addict. Dad was mean to him and just was, and so you wonder, how did he get to be the way he is? You know, and really what we're dealing with here is a combination of the issues that society is dealing with today. We mentioned drugs and alcohol, mental health issues, and so on and so on. You know, poverty is a real serious issue. And how is it, you know, what's the relationship to poverty and early learning? There was a study done in Appalachia. Only 16% of those homes had a book in it. Only 16% had a book. Yes, and that's why the library is a part of our initiative down in Franklin County, because we want to get more books in. But, you know, we talk about ready to learn, getting to school. I'm telling you, you know, there's a direct relationship. In Kentucky, just alone, 50% ready to learn. I realize that's another state. Came to school ready to learn. But of those that were from Appalachia and in poverty, only 22%. I mean, that's a study that was done in Kentucky. And you know, but the point is, all of these, I don't care if it's Kentucky or Pennsylvania or Franklin County or Dauphin County or where you are, it's all the same general information. And so what this is a two-generational approach. And because, you know, you say, well, how are you going to teach a baby? No, we're not going to teach a baby. We're going to teach parents about how they can understand. Everybody wants better for their child. Find one parent that doesn't want better. They all want better, but they don't know how to do it. My children were born 36 years ago. Okay, so I'm dating myself here a little bit. My wife and I went to the hospital for prenatal stuff and knowing how to breathe and all that sort of thing. But after the children were born, because we had twins, guess what? You're up to your own now. Now, we were fortunate to have local grandparents and all that sort of thing. We were fortunate, but not everybody has that.
Yeah, a lot of parents are learning on the job.
No, they don't. I mean, just a basic fact is something I picked up just in, you know, back in February. When a child is born, their brain is at 25% of an adult size. You say, well, what's the point in that? In 1 year, that brain grows to 75% of an adult size. And what is that child doing? And just look at any baby and just observe. And so we want to raise the awareness. And those kids are always looking around. They're observing their environment. They're listening. They're listening to what people are saying. They're learning their language. They're going to learn and speak a language in 2 years. You try to do that as an adult.
Mm-hmm. real quick, the event, is it aimed at any particular age group?
No, it's open for, it's primarily about the first 2 years.
Okay.
So from birth and even prenatal to that point. To 2 years. That's what the focus will be on. And again, that is where oftentimes, you know, when we talk to politicians or some others, they talk about early childhood education as being Head Start or pre-K or something like that. And I'm going to tell you something, it really starts from the day the child's born.
Yeah. Susan Grimm Thomas, you said something that I'm curious about. You said challenging these children, that they need to be challenged. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think anybody, Bob's described watching young babies and the idea that kids are curious, they're constantly wanting to interact with the world around them, and having an adult there with them that understands how this is all happening and asks them to think, asks them to not just, you know, to really kind of stop and think, well, how does that work? How did that fit together? When kids are, when their minds are occupied and they're continually learning, I think any kindergarten teacher would tell you that's when kids, when they're engaged and they're focused, any early childhood teacher would tell you a focused kid is a kid that's going to be happy. And so it's a matter of understanding how kids are putting together their environment and starting to build concepts and learn and being able to set up an environment for them that is going to allow them to do that. And then have you help them kind of think through what are they doing and observe their own learning and kind of think about it.
Do they do that through play? And we're talking that 0 to 2 years old. Exploring, observing, play.
Yes.
But all those things are part of a curriculum, even at that age.
Yes. So a quality early learning provider is going to understand the importance of play. they're going to not just see kids stacking blocks, they're going to understand from physical development to the social development of needing to negotiate who gets the blocks, the verbal skills that kids need to have as they describe what's going on, cognitively trying to think through how things, and you know, visually, spatially, how do I put things on top? So that early learning provider is thinking about all of those different things in what looks like a simple back and forth, I'm playing with you.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And a parent who understands early childhood development knows that they need to spend as much as time as they can with that child, reading books to them, getting them interested in books, playing with them, as we mentioned, singing with them. And there's so many things and what not to do. And understanding stress levels. You know, having a baby can be stressful. A parent needs to understand when that stress gets to a breaking point that they can call in somebody and take a break, because we all need to have a break. Mm.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about an early childhood education event that is being held in Chambersburg on June 15th, Friday, June 15th. Actually, that's just the start of our conversation about early childhood education today with Karen Grimm-Thomas, who is Director of External Relations with the Pennsylvania Office of Child Development and Early Learning, and Franklin County Commissioner Bob Thomas. If you'd like to weigh in, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Pat in Waynesboro. Pat, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner Thomas.
Good morning to you.
Yes. Well, this is a very interesting discussion that I just stumbled across listening to the radio this morning. And my husband and my mother was a kindergarten teacher. My mother-in-law was a first grade teacher. My concern is that there will be too much emphasis on learning the ABCs and all of that, and not enough time for play in all this push for academic excellence. Mm-hmm. And
Well, Pat, before you go any further, there was just in the news last week, there was a story about a study that said just that with so much emphasis, parents are putting so much emphasis on preparing their children for school academically that they don't allow them to have fun. They don't allow them to play.
And this play we're talking about is the learning part. The learning part that our caller's referencing, I totally agree with, but that will take care of itself. That's what Karen was saying. But you got to start it with the simplistic playing aspect, and they're playing, not realizing they're learning. You know, my grandchild, you know, thanks to my wife, you know, he got a tremendous start. He went into kindergarten at a third grade level. He really did. But it's all because of what he got. He was playing with toys that had numbers on them, and just all the things that Karen was just talking about, he got. And that is what gave him that start.
Mm-hmm. But Karen, how do we balance that play just to have fun? I mean, there's learning going on while mm-hmm. kids are just having fun, but how do we make that balance? Because, I mean, even there will be people hearing this program today, okay, I got to do more with my child, but at the same time, you got to give him or her some room to just be a kid.
Oh, you're totally right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we've now understand a lot about the importance of self-directed play, and that... you know, that adults can definitely get in the way. So I think for our office, that's why thinking through the staff that are in the classroom, whether it's working in an infant-toddler program or a preschool program or a pre-K program, that those folks are really grounded in child development. They really understand the age group that they're working with, and they understand the importance of it's that balance between allowing kids to do everything, you know, as much as they can on their own, but being that person on the side that sets the environment up, that ensures that the materials are where they need to be so that kids can have those experiences, and then afterwards asks them about it and talks to them about it and has them think through what is it that you, what happened when you did that? Did you see that? And, you know, but it really is this balance, and it comes down to that staff person really understanding child development and what that, with that, that age group that they're working with needs.
You know, to a point here, and it gets to our caller's question, is Brenda Hardin-Jones talked about this in Washington. When a child is done, you let them go because that's part of their learning experience of exploring and so on like that. So it's not like you're just sitting there and you're like in the classroom. You know, I think that's very, very important to realize that a child, especially a baby, is still a baby. And we got to let the baby be a baby. And part of that being a baby is just being themselves. And it's not always going to be what you want to be. But I can tell you, if you introduce one of that baby to books and read them with these fun things, they'll want to keep reading.
I have to tell you, I'm impressed with all those bees you just strung together without stumbling over be a baby, books, babies.
Yeah. I didn't even thought what I said.
Okay. We have a listener emailed, said, my children went to preschool because it was what I did. However, paying out of pocket was difficult.
Absolutely.
The children that did not go to preschool or daycare in my daughter's classes hold the kids that went to preschool back. I've explained to my daughters that not everyone could go to preschool, and the kids that did not go to preschool are behind. That is why you have to do busy work at your desk when they're getting extra help or having behavior problems. I don't want them to be angry with those kids, but it is hurting their educational experience and possibilities because of the kids that cannot go to preschool. Also, I had to cash out my retirement account to pay for preschool, and I was assessed a large fee because it was not approved use of a 401k. So there's a lot of problems there with that. But let's, and I think our last caller, and she didn't get to this question, but I'll kind of take them one by one. In, she was from Waynesboro, one of your constituents, and one of the questions she had is, this event on Saturday and talking about the June 15th, is that how it's being paid for? Is it something coming out of taxpayer funds?
No. Actually, I'm glad you asked. We have a sponsor. We reached out and we have a sponsor. We'll give them credit there. And
you can credit now if you want.
It's very Perform Care. They perform many of the programs that we provide as a subcontractor, and they do very well. But you know, they agreed because it's important. You know, again, for the same reasons we mentioned in the beginning. But no, there's no tax dollars going to this whatsoever, and it's going to be a very limited cost event. Brenda Hardin is donating her service, driving up here.
So, getting back to our email though, she brought up a couple issues. Let's talk about cost to begin with. I know the Department of Education, Karen, has several programs to help low-income families with not just pre-K, but a number of early education initiatives. But by the sounds of things, it can be expensive.
It can be very expensive.
Yep.
We've, you know, the Research for Action is a group out of Philadelphia that did a study just about a year ago looking at what is the true cost of quality care. And we know that for infants, it comes out to be the average daily cost is right around $73 a day. So, and that's for high quality care. That's for a setting where the materials are what they need to be. The staff has a background in education. The staff is paid well. They have benefits. So we know that that's a huge expense. Infants are more expensive than older groups because infant care is just our ratios are lower. There's one adult to every four kids, so those costs are going to be higher because of that. We have our Child Care Works program, which for families that qualify, there's a sliding scale where families would have to pay anywhere from, I believe the lowest copay is $5 a week, and they're assessed at that, you know, on depending on what their income is, that will pay child care providers and offset some of those costs. But we know that that we've got currently right under 8,000 children on our waiting list for Child Care Works. So those are 8,000 kids that are not you know, in those quality classrooms now because we just don't have the money to pay for the slot.
Mm-hmm. Now, her other point about the children that did go through some of these programs in the same classrooms in kindergarten and first grade mm-hmm. as those that didn't. And, I mean, this is an issue that throughout our academic years we still deal with, but it seems like it's even more pronounced when you have some children who are prepared and some who aren't.
I can't speak that this is at every classroom across the state, but I had that same concern about my grandson to the point that I talked with the leaders of the early childhood program in Chambersburg, and I was absolutely given total confidence. They said, you can be assured. They take each child in the classroom at a different pace. I don't know how you do it, but they do it. And I will tell you, it has not slowed down my grandson. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. And they do, here again, I don't know how. Maybe
well,
you do,
she,
but I
don't.
You know,
but she, in her experience, the listener's experience, it was slowing down her children.
Well, see, I don't know about every classroom.
How do you deal with that, Karen?
It's a challenge, I think, particularly in areas where there is a wide range of kids' experiences. Kids come to formalized schooling. They come to kindergarten from a wide variety of backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And again, it speaks to the need for our early learning providers, our teachers, to be really skilled. They need to have a really good understanding of child development, and they need to have a really good understanding. They have to have good pedagogy behind them where they really understand how to support kids at different levels.
You know, I noticed, Commissioner, that with Dr. Johnson, it is Harden, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Dr. Brenda Jones Harden from the University of Maryland, that one of her specialties is talking about children at risk.
Yes.
That, you know, one of the things she talks about is kids who are in foster care or children who have grown up in poverty or children who have grown up in abusive homes or yes. where substance abuse is a problem. Yeah. Is that something that will be dealt with at this event? And
absolutely.
How much of an issue is it?
It is a huge issue. And that is, you know, what we're dealing with here is called adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. And if anyone wants to look it up, just Google search ACEs, A-C-E-S. Okay, it's not ACE the store, mm-hmm. but ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And you'll see all kinds of information. It was a study, it was done. I think it was 17,000 participants. This was not a nickel and dime study. And it looked at 10 huge issues, generally on abuse, neglect, or household dysfunction. 10 questions. And I'm telling you, you want to have a program someday to talk about
it? Oh, I've talked about it.
I'm telling you.
Needs more attention.
There's a whole lot more attention needs to be given to this because, again, the more check marks you have out of those 10 questions, and the percentage of the population that has 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, you know, why is it important? At one of the conferences here, if I could find this thing.
You do have a lot of paperwork.
I did. I know. I said I overprepared. But an ACE study, this was at a conference here, of a child that had 6 ACE check marks.
Right.
Now, that's 10 issues. Okay, 10. 6 out of 10. Versus a child that had 0. And there's not very many that have 0. Okay, there's because, believe me, I had 3 in my household. But the point is, though, 6 versus 0, that 6 will be 4,600% more likely to be an IV drug user.
Mm.
I'm telling you, that is incredible.
That is an incredible
stat. But that's why this is important.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a call from Egan in Lancaster. Egan, you're on the air.
Good morning. Children are very fast in learning languages. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they can learn multiple languages at the same time and not get them confused. They separate them correctly. And this is natural. This is average. This is not genius. And unless you want to say that all children are geniuses, which is actually true. So education from 0 to 3 is really, it's really natural, and we should be doing it and we should be behind it 100%, and all children can mingle, interact with children of other languages, and they'll understand each other like we adults can. Thank you for
listening. Egan, thank you very much for your call. I mean, just what he was describing, it is such, that age group, they're sponges. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it's almost a cliche, but it is a sponge for everything they see, everything they observe. As far as the language goes, just think about that. How amazing that is, that in the first 2 years of life, that children are learning a whole language.
Right. It really comes down to brain development.
And big time.
You know, what happens in those first 3 years in terms of the neural connections that are made. The brain is an incredibly efficient thing, and so it does prune. It does stop using certain things. If you're not going to use them, it says, well, this must not be necessary. So as you get older, those kinds of connections are, it's not that we can't do it, it just becomes much harder because those connections have dropped off because the brain is efficient and trying to move on and work on what it needs to. You know, you keep using this part of your brain, you must really need that.
Absolutely.
So we're going to store it up.
Yeah, and that's huge issue. You know, we know you need to exercise your body. You've got to exercise your brain. Even as an adult, in the senior, they talk about doing certain
things.
Right,
being active.
But children, they're coming into a brand new world, and they only thing they know is what they heard in the womb in the final couple months.
Yeah.
Okay?
By the way, and I'm just going to add this, Rebecca from Enola says she's distressed at the number of parents she sees who are on their phone while out in public and rarely talking to their children. So I'm just going to add that when we're talking about language.
Well, I want to tell you, we had a speaker in Chambersburg a couple weeks ago, and I forget what the percentage was, but it was a very high percentage of third graders. When asked about, do you feel respected? And it was a very high percent by your parents. Very high percentage said no. I don't want to say what that percentage was, but I'm telling you, it was over 50.
Because
it was exactly right.
Attention,
it was exactly
phones,
that point. We spend too much time on our technology and less time with our children.
Yeah. Commissioner Bob Thomas for Franklin County, Karen Grimm Thomas, no relation, Director of External Relations, Office of Child Development and Early Learning. Thank you very much for being with us, Commissioner. If someone is interested in attending this conference on June 15th, what can they do?
Well, maybe you could put this as a link on your website, but it would be nice if it could be done.
Heather Woolridge, my producer, has already done that.
That's fantastic. So go to the WITF website and search somehow and get it done. But we do have a registration, and one thing that needs to be pointed out, Chambersburg Borough has agreed to give free parking. It is downtown at the Capitol Theater.
Right.
It's 9:00 in the morning on a Friday morning. So free parking, and anybody who registers will get an email about other places to park for free.
Okay.
So
that's good, but maybe you should teach those kids that nothing's free in life.
Well, trust me.
Hey, thank you very much for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The spectacular video of the Kilauea volcano eruption in Hawaii has captured the world's attention. Kilauea may not be the largest or most dangerous volcano, but the video has provided views inside and outside the volcano of lava and its flow that many have never seen before. Then there was the tragic Fuego volcano that erupted Sunday in Guatemala, spewing rock and ash that killed at least 69 people. There are hundreds missing that they continue to search for today. Joining us is Dr. Ben Edwards, who is a professor of earth sciences at Dickinson College in Carlisle and an expert on volcanoes and glaciers, I understand. Dr. Edwards, thank you very much for being with us today.
Nice to be here. Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment about volcanoes, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Is it unusual that we have two, I guess, volcano eruptions? I was about to say major eruptions, but two eruptions like this at the same time, like we've had in Guatemala and Hawaii?
Not that unusual. It's kind of unusual to have this much stuff going on where there are extensive damage. And of course, every day with Twitter and social media, things get sent out faster and faster, so we know about things. There are 20 plus or minus active volcanoes at any one time that are doing something. This is slightly unusual to have such big eruptions going on at the same time, but certainly not unheard of. And there are many other volcanoes that have some stage of activity right now as well.
What is a big volcano in your mind?
Well, it can be the size of the volcano. I mean, usually we're talking about the size of the eruption. And Kilauea has been erupting for 35 years. So it's not like it was, you know, quiet and all of a sudden it burst to life. The same is true with Fuego. Fuego has been erupting on and off, you know, for decades and having really kind of low level of eruptions that periodically do get bigger. So this isn't unheard of for Fuego to have this kind of eruption. We give it a something called the volcanic explosivity index, which is kind of similar to the magnitudes that we use for earthquakes. And this eruption, the preliminary reports I've heard would be a VEI of 3. And if you look back on the history of the volcano, even, you know, to the 80s, it's had a number of eruptions this size, and you know, it's almost always active. This was just a bigger burst than they've had for a little while, and people were kind of caught unaware. Same thing with Kilauea. I mean, the you know, the summit and a place called Pu'uo has been having eruptions since 1983, and even just a few years ago, there was a breakout on the East Fissure Zone, which is where the eruption's happening now, that went through a little place called Pahoa and actually damaged a few houses, but that eruption was relatively short-lived. So it's a change in activity and a little bit of a change in style for both these two volcanoes from what's happened in the recent past. But we know from going back a little bit more detail that this really isn't unusual. Kilauea, if you look at some of the maps that are online, there are lava flows from the 1800s, 1950s, 1960s that came very similar areas to what we're seeing today.
You said that, and heard news reports since the weekend on Fuego, that the population around there was caught a little bit by surprise. How are you surprised that, as you said, I mean, this has been an active volcano for years. How is one surprised that it erupts?
Well, I mean, the same could be said about Kilauea. I mean, a lot of the houses in Kilauea that are being inundated now, if you look at a risk map for lava flows, they're in the number one risk zone.
Is there such a thing?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And the same is true for Fuego. I mean, it's one of the things that, especially in the last 20 or 30 years, has really changed is the production of hazard maps. And so many volcanoes I don't know about all, but many volcanoes have these hazard maps drawn up that are basically trying to predict the dangerous places for people to be during an eruption. And, you know, The problem is you could, you know, build a house in beautiful Hawaii or on the slopes of Fuego volcano, maybe because there's good farming, there's rich soils, and maybe you're fine for 30 or 40 years and nothing happens. Or you could build a house tomorrow and it could get wiped out 3 weeks after it's finished. And people are willing to take risks to live in some places, and that's what you see happen a little bit. Some of it is governments that don't have maybe as much funding as they need for hazard development.
Guatemala, I would think, is a problem there.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, we have 20 million people at risk in the U.S. living on active faults in California. And you know, there's going to be a big earthquake in California, in Los Angeles or San Francisco at some point in the future. We can't really move 30 million people out of danger's way once they're already there. So it becomes a problem as we recognize more and more hazards in places where people already live, and it can be really difficult to know what to do.
Mm. This is what you said earlier, I think, is so true. I described Kilauea as so spectacular, and I think one of the reasons that it does seem so spectacular is because we are seeing it, that nowadays you have people with cell phones that are taking video, you know, helicopters or TV cameras flying over top of the volcano, and you've seen that spectacular explosions of the lava coming up, and, you know, I've heard so many people saying, oh, I've never seen anything like this before. Those are not unusual. It's just that people are seeing them now, right?
That's definitely part of it. I mean, if you go back to various stages, especially in the 80s of the eruption at Kilauea, there were spectacular lava fountains then as well and spectacular lava flows. And if you go to the Hawaii Volcano Observatory website, you can see a lot of incredible pictures from those times. But, you know, there's not nearly as much video, and certainly it wasn't being circulated in the 1980s the way it is now. I mean, now, in fact, you know, it's difficult because people are doing drone flights in places where they're not necessarily supposed to, and there's been some social media concerns about people retweeting posts of videos that look really great. But the problem is some of those videos are being taken by basically people flying their drones illegally into places that are dangerous.
Yeah.
And so it's the same thing with Fuego. There are these videos of people standing on bridges watching these hot gas and ash clouds coming down the drainage right at them. And, you know, some of the videos you see, you know, the camera sort of moving away really quickly. But people sometimes are almost, it almost looks like they're kind of putting themselves in danger's way, either because they don't understand or because they're trying to get that video that's going to go viral online.
Got to get the shot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to go back to one of the basics. You know, we're seeing reports on the news about these two volcanoes. What is a volcano and what causes a volcano to erupt?
Wow. So
I know. That's a broad one.
So literally a volcano is simply a place at the surface of the earth where melted rock comes out of the ground. And the earth, really, really, really simple and short, but the earth has three main chemical layers to it. There's a core, which is mainly made of iron and nickel. That's what makes Earth's magnetic field. There's the mantle of the Earth, which is by far the biggest volume of our planet. If you think of the planet as a ball, and you're going to calculate what the volume of different layers of the ball is, the mantle is about 80%. And what I teach my students, and we chant this in class to sort of ingrain it in their minds, we say, mantle melting makes basalt. And so when you see basalt, that means it's coming from melting in the mantle of the Earth. And that's about the only place you can actually really make a basaltic, we call basaltic magma. So a magma is liquid rock that's inside the Earth. And when it gets to the Earth's surface, we call it lava. And the best analogy I can use is that if you have a soda bottle, when you've got the lid on the soda bottle, that's your magma. So it's under pressure. You know that there's gas dissolved in it, right? Because when you open it up, you can hear the gas coming out. Yeah, and you can see the bubbles. And that's really the difference between a magma and a lava. Because a magma's got gases in it, and those gases are one of the reasons why the magma's actually moving up, because they make the magma less dense than the surrounding rocks, and so they start to float through the surrounding rocks. When they get to very close to your surface, or at your surface, it's like you've taken the lid off the soda bottle, now all the gas can come out.
So what's more dangerous to humans, lava, gas, ash?
Boy, the combination of ash and gas produce what are called pyroclastic density currents. And we used to call these things pyroclastic flows, but for a lot of technical reasons, we've decided that a density current is a better word than a flow. And part of it is to make sure that people don't confuse these sort of clouds of ash, and sometimes they can have blocks as big as the table in front of me, couple meters long, that people don't confuse that with lava flows. And that actually happened at Fuego. Some of the initial news was, oh, Fuego's producing deadly lava flows. And Fuego does produce lava flows. But for the most part, lavas are going to get stuff that can't move. If you're in a car, if you're human, if you know the ways to go, most of the time you can travel faster than a lava flow. These hot gas ash flows, pyroclastic density currents, or sometimes they're called pyroclastic surges if they're almost all gas. These gases are 300 or 400 degrees Fahrenheit, so they burn you. They burn your lungs if you ingest them, and they can move. They can move 100 plus miles an hour. So you really can't outrun them, even in a car, if they're coming kind of unimpeded down the slopes of a volcano. So they're probably the most dangerous if you're within 20 or 30 miles of the top of the volcano.
relationship. Now we can predict from what you're saying. We can predict volcanoes. We can't predict earthquakes. Why?
Well, so we can't predict everything about volcanoes, right? We
didn't not predict everything,
but still.
We have a general idea when one is ready to bubble.
For the most part, although we don't always know, there's places like Yellowstone, places like Long Valley Caldera. There are some big volcanoes that are constantly in a state of sort of activity with earthquakes and things like that, but they're not actually erupting. And so we can't certainly, if we could predict to the day or the hour when a volcano was going to erupt, then we would have moved everyone away from Fuego.
Right.
And we do kind of have this global model of the Earth called plate tectonics, and that actually allows us to predict where a lot of volcanoes are and also where a lot of earthquakes are going to occur. The problem is trying to understand when something's going to break is which is what happens during an earthquake. You can imagine taking a wooden pencil and pencils. Your young viewers may not know what a pencil is, but they could go to the store and still find one. You can bend a pencil and you can actually hear it start to snap. Right, it snaps a little bit. You can hear it crackle, but it's hard to predict how long, and it depends on how fast you bend it when it's actually going to break. And so that's the same thing along fault zones where there are earthquakes. We can measure the amount of stress and strain that are building up along an earthquake fault zone, but because there's a lot of rock, it's really hard to predict exactly when the rock is going to crack and the earthquake's going to happen.
I'm jumping around on you, but in the few minutes we have, I want to try to get to as many things as possible. I remember when Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, a lot of ash that went into the sky. Again, it was a spectacular video, even in 1980. Cooler temperatures the next year. We have two volcanoes here, and I don't know whether they're as large as Mount St. Helens, but will there be any impact on weather or temperatures in the coming months because of these volcanoes?
At this stage, it doesn't sound like it. That's a whole another complicated field of sort of interactions of volcanoes and climate, and it's pretty complicated. A lot of times when you have global cooling associated with an eruption, it's something like the Mount Pinatubo eruption, where you were putting gases and small particles called aerosols up into the upper part of the troposphere and the stratosphere. So you have to get gases up really high into the atmosphere, and they have to be able to spread basically around the globe to cause that kind of global cooling. At this stage, I would say no. These kinds of eruptions, what's happened at least right now, aren't likely to do that.
I have a question from Kit in Montour County. He asks, can you explain a hot spot and the various geographic zones that cause magma lava zones?
Yeah, so if you can find a map online of plate tectonics and tectonic boundaries, almost all of those edges of tectonic plates will be places where there'll be volcanoes. An exception at places like Yellowstone and places like Hawaii, which we think are formed by the mantle coming up and acting almost like a blowtorch underneath the tectonic plates. So Kilauea is in the middle of the Hawaiian tectonic plate. And if you can imagine a piece of steel and you're going to cut through a piece of steel with a blowtorch, you put the blowtorch under the steel, you cut through it, and then if you start pulling that steel plate over the blowtorch and the blowtorch is held in one place, you start cutting through the plate. That's the analogy we use for a hot spot and how it produces volcanoes in the middle of a tectonic plate.
Boy, there's so much more we could talk about. We only have about a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And, you were talking earlier about people getting too close. I read some stories about you getting pretty close to, what was it, there was snow you were
studying? Tolbachek, yeah.
Yeah, were you only about 15 feet away from lava?
Well, more like 2 feet. I was getting samples and taking temperatures.
Hey, well, you still have your legs, so I guess you're successful. Dr. Edwards, thank you very much for being with us today. What should people know? As they're following these stories with these volcanoes, what should they know? What kind of basic knowledge should they know about volcanoes in about 30 seconds or less?
You always want to go to volcano observatories for your first bit of information. There's all kinds of people on social media and Twitter, and there are actually a fair number of volcanologists that do answer questions and provide information. But always sort of the first source of information where you can should always be a volcano observatory. The Hawaii Volcano Observatory's got all kinds of maps and links to what's going on in the eruption. And, you know, the main thing is if you're traveling to a place where there are volcanoes, you can find out information now, especially online, what the volcano is doing. Do you need to be worried about sulfur in the air and things like that? So just check things out before you go.
Dr. Ben Edwards is professor of earth sciences at Dickinson College. Dr. Edwards, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great to be here.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking with the new director of the Pennsylvania Historic and Museum Commission. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. We talk about a little bit of history, so be sure to tune in.